Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you today on WILL AM 580 from beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Today we have as our guest the editor of the longest-standing independent socialist magazine in the United States and one of the leading socialist writers, intellectuals, public intellectuals, and one of the leading environmental sociologists in the United States today. So please join us today for Media Matters, but first, let's go to Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news relating to the intersection of media and democracy. I'm John Anderson.
And I'm Kimberly Cronick.
The Federal Communications Commission has sent letters of inquiry to the owners of 77 television stations in 34 states that were caught earlier this year attempting to pass off video news releases from major corporations as legitimate journalism. Diane Farsetta, senior researcher at the Center for Media and Democracy, co-authored the investigative report that spurred the probe, which included dozens of on-air clips from stations caught in the act. She says the violations of public disclosure rules are clear and penalties are in order.
The FCC needs to fine some stations at least, if not take other actions against them.
Other actions could range from an official FCC admonishment attached to an offending TV station's license file to outright license revocation and even criminal proceedings. Although this is the first ever FCC investigation of its kind, Farsetta is cautiously optimistic that the agency will do the right thing.
I do know that we're up against some deep-pocketed interests, but this is a flagrant breach of current law. So, I mean, I think this is sort of a make or break point for the FCC, that either they enforce the laws on the books or they cease to be taken seriously.
When CMD's report was first released in April, many in the TV news business first tried to ignore it and then downplayed its findings as the chronicle of a few lazy reporters. But the number of stations involved in the VNR scam, outed after a sampling of less than 1% of all VNRs in circulation, suggests the problem of fake news remains pervasive, and Farsetta says they've got more evidence to prove it.
We're going to go public with our new findings within the next month or two, but I can just broadly say that of all the attention that's been paid to this and all of the strong actions that the FCC has taken, TV stations still haven't gotten the message.
While all of the video news releases identified in the CMD study came from corporate sponsors, there haven't been any recent reviews of the use of government VNRs without proper disclosure. However, we do know that things are still a bit shady in that scene. Recently, it came to light that Deputy Assistant Labor Secretary Karen Czarnecki has been moonlighting on TV talk shows identified only as a conservative strategist. The Labor Department's ethics advisors have signed off on the FaceTime since Czarnecki never purports to speak on behalf of the department, though she does get paid for her appearances on public TV programs.
The United States Supreme Court has agreed to hear a challenge to an antitrust lawsuit filed against the nation's largest telephone companies. AT&T, Bell South, Quest, and Verizon are being sued for colluding to carve up the country into specific geographic territories where one company would dominate. At issue in this particular challenge is whether the standard of collusion alleged in the lawsuit is high enough to permit proper litigation. A large segment of corporate America has already filed briefs with the High Court, pleading for it to throw out the case. Oral arguments could be heard as early as October. And although the mergers of SBC with AT&T and Verizon with MCI have been approved by regulators, a federal judge conducting a final review is questioning whether the conditions of those deals are good enough to promote competition in a national marketplace for phone service that has now just three dominant players. He's apparently concerned that regulators did not conduct enough diligent oversight of the transactions. Though it's unlikely the judge could reverse the mergers, he could impose more stringent conditions on them. And rulings of that sort could be used as precedent in future strategic corporate marriages, such as AT&T's planned $67 billion buyout of Bell South.
In related news, a federal judge in Detroit has declared the National Security Agency's warrantless wiretapping of phone and internet traffic to be unconstitutional and ordered it be halted immediately. It's the first ruling of its kind involving several lawsuits filed across the country challenging the growing security state. Additionally, 17 lawsuits filed against AT&T, Bell South, and Verizon for their alleged collusion in the spy scheme have been consolidated into a single case. It will be heard in the Northern District of California, where the first of the 17 cases was filed, and where a judge recently blocked a government attempt to have the case dismissed on state secrecy grounds. The consolidation decision is also considered a win by privacy advocates. The phone companies and federal government wanted the cases consolidated in a court in Washington, D.C., whose rulings have been historically favorable to government and corporate litigants. You've been listening to Media Minutes, a joint production of the Illinois Initiative for Media Policy Research at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign and Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization dedicated to media democracy. For more information, visit our website at freepress.net.
Greetings. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, here on WILL AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. I'm coming to you from Campbell Hall on the campus of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Today we have as our guest one of the leading public intellectuals in the United States, John Bellamy Foster, the author of more than 10 books, many highly acclaimed and award-winning, on a variety of subjects dealing with political economy, sociology, and the environment, politics in general. His latest book, Naked Imperialism, is an examination of the U.S. role in the world, both post and pre-9/11. Foster's also written widely on the environment and on environmental politics, and he is the editor of Monthly Review magazine. Founded in 1949, it is the longest-standing independent socialist magazine in the United States, and Foster is here today in our studios in Campbell Hall to talk about his work as an author, as a scholar, and as editor of Monthly Review. And I should add that John Bellamy Foster is also a professor of sociology at the University of Oregon in Eugene, Oregon. So it's a pleasure to welcome John Foster to Media Matters.
Thank you, Bob. I'm glad to be here.
Well, John, let's talk about your new book first, Naked Imperialism, just published by Monthly Review Press, literally just published, out in August 2006. Why the title Naked Imperialism?
Well, there has been a lot of discussion recently of the new empire or the new imperialism in the United States, the new imperial order. And this is something that is discussed not simply by radicals, but it's very, very widespread in the mainstream literature. The New York Times, the New York Review of Books, the Council on Foreign Relations publication, Foreign Affairs, right through the entire media and public affairs of the United States, they're talking about empire imperialism. You're more likely to find discussions of empire and imperialism on the right now than you are on the left. This is a new thing. There's not since 1898 has imperialism, empire, imperial order on the part of the United States been defended and promoted within the establishment among the elites. And the question is, why? People have talked about the new imperialism. What's new about it? And as I thought about it, certainly imperialism is something that's been ongoing for the United States. It's never really been absent in the literature, in the academic and public policy literature. They'll sometimes talk about formal imperialism, which is old-style colonialism, but also formal imperialism usually means political control, the use of military force.
Like Nigeria is a colony of England or Britain.
But anything that involves political control or the use of military force, such as in the United States and Iraq today. And then there's the term informal imperialism, which refers to economic control without political controls, without definite political controls or military force. And the United States has been seen as exercising informal imperialism, even when it wasn't exercising formal imperialism. These terms are used right up at the top. For example, Richard Hess, who was the deputy political analyst in the State Department, and he was right under Colin Powell, talked about the need for a new imperialism, a new imperial age on the part of the United States, and used these terms formal and informal imperialism, and argued for the United States moving towards a more formal imperialism. So this language is sometimes even used within the Bush administration itself. And it became clear that we were no longer simply exercising informal imperialism or economic imperialism, but the United States was now using its war machine and to move into those areas of the world that we wanted to control by political and military means for geopolitical purposes, such as the Middle East, Central Asia to some extent, Africa. And this is a big shift. And so people started calling it the new imperialism. But what changed the most was the nakedness with which this was occurring. And the question then becomes, why is it so much more naked? Why is the naked use of force, naked exertion of political control by the United States over other countries more prominent today than it was, say, 20, 30 years ago? Mm-hmm. And this is underlying theme of the book, to explain why we're in a new era.
And John Bellamy Foster, in a nutshell, what are some of the factors that explain why we now have unclothed imperialism in the United States?
Well, the story really goes back to 1971. I think that's one of the turning points was August 1971, when Nixon ended the dollar gold standard. Before that, the dollar was convertible into gold and changed the international monetary system, basically breaking with the original rules of Bretton Woods system. But it also signaled that the dollar was no longer as powerful as it had been previously, that the U.S. economy was losing ground to other rising economies in that period, Europe and Japan and so on. And the United States was no longer an unrivaled hegemonic power or unrivaled dominant power
as it
economically.
Had been between 1945 and 1971.
Yes. In 1945, the United States had something like 50% of industrial production in the world, or manufacturing production, I think it was. By the early 1970s, I think it had dropped to half of that.
Well, I suspect it's half that again today, if not less.
No, they've stabilized that decline, but it's a slower decline mm-hmm. now. But the United States is no longer as economically powerful as it once was, and this was signaled in 1971. And part of that was the result of the Vietnam War, the spread of dollars all over the world to support the empire and the war, and created the euro-dollar market, where dollars were in European banks and elsewhere in large quantities, and which undermined the strength of the dollar at that time. And this was accompanied by a whole set of other changes that occurred at that time. First of all, the United States, it was clear by the early 70s, had been defeated in the Vietnam War, and the American population had what the conservatives called the Vietnam syndrome. The American population was reluctant to support wars in third world countries, and the Vietnam War had been a defeat of the U.S. empire. There was also an economic crisis, the first big economic crisis in the post-Second World War period. They had had economic crises, but during the golden age of the late 1950s and 60s, there had been very rapid economic growth in the period 1974-5. There was an economic crisis that signaled, Monthly Review argued at that time, and it's proven to be true, that it signaled a decline in economic growth that was going to be a fairly permanent decline, lowering of growth, which
growth
we called
rates.
Of growth rates, which we called stagnation, and so it was a long term shift in the economy towards a economy of relative economic stagnation, much slower growth, and slower growth it became more difficult to increase profits except through redistribution, that is, except by taking more from the poor to the rich.
Yeah.
And so there was an economic crisis that in many ways became a permanent problem of economic stagnation that persists in our time. And the whole world economy slowed down, with only a few exceptions. But the world economy as a whole followed the United States into a period of stagnation. So you have U.S. decline of its economic power, and you have the growth of economic stagnation. Another thing that happened about the same time, it was you had the Yom Kippur War, and you had the formation of OPEC.
Yeah.
And also OAPEC, which is the Arab oil producing countries, and there was the oil boycott against the United States for supporting Israel, and that generated an energy crisis in the United States, and it was the first sign that the United States was severely dependent on foreign oil, and it also was a way of signaling just how severe the environmental crisis was, and that was discovered. So all of these things came about at the same time, you have this decline of U.S. power. The problem then becomes how to restore it.
Yeah.
How to restore it. So for a long time they were dealing with this crisis in the Reagan period in the beginning of the 1980s. The empire started to strike back. Actually, even before that, in the end of Jimmy Carter's presidency. The United States was not intervening as often in the Third World, and there were all sorts of countries that broke away from U.S. control. There were countries like Nicaragua in Central America, but the biggest and there were countries in Africa like Angola, but the biggest loss to the U.S. empire in the period after the Vietnam War was the Iranian Revolution in 1979. Our dictator, the Shah, was overthrown, and that was one of the major bases of U.S. power in the Middle East. The U.S. power in the Middle East was based on Iran and Israel, and the loss of Iran was very severe, and the consequences of that carry down to the present day. We had actually set the Shah, put the Shah in power originally in the 50s, and his overthrow was a huge defeat of the U.S. empire and a destabilization of U.S. control of the Middle East. So that became a major problem, and Jimmy Carter decided declared that the United States was, it's called the Carter Doctrine, that the United States would intervene militarily in the Middle East to prevent any other power from having dominance. But his Carter Doctrine was modeled after the Monroe Doctrine, and what it really meant was that the United States was going to insist on its own military hegemony over the Middle East. And this has been part of some thinkers like Andrew Bacevich have said that was the beginning of a third world war. Certainly the story carries down from there. But the other thing, the other big event was the collapse of the Soviet Union.
John Bellamy Foster is recording this show with me a couple days before going on air while he is in town in Urbana, Illinois, visiting. It's a pleasure to have him on the show today. So please sit back, relax, enjoy the show. Don't try to call in. Let John Bellamy Foster do the talking. Right now we're talking about the new version of imperialism, what he calls naked imperialism in the United States today, and giving a historical explanation of recent history, how we got to this point. And as we left off, as I recall, the Soviet Union's collapse.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, so we have economic stagnation, the decline of U.S. economic hegemony, the Iranian Revolution, and the loss of control of the Middle East, and all of these events represented a serious structural crisis for U.S. empire. And in the 1980s, they tried to deal with these not very effectively. The crisis continued. In 1989, you saw the collapse of, the fall of Berlin Wall, the collapse of the Eastern European states, and in 1991, in the summer of 1991, the Soviet Union itself collapsed, and after the Berlin Wall fell, the first thing the United States did was invade Panama, but soon after the Berlin Wall fell, and it was clear that the Soviet Union was extremely weakened. You had the Saddam Hussein's invasion of Kuwait, and this is a very confusing event. It seems like Saddam Hussein, who was our ally in the Iraq-Iran war, and we supported him against Iran. We supported Iraq, that regime against Iran, and Hussein expected to get some rewards from being the ally, and at least thought he was being told by the United States that it was okay to invade Kuwait or at least take over the oil fields and the border. When we don't really know what happened, but he invaded Kuwait. The United States decided to go to war rather than negotiate. And it was clear, one thing that was clear geopolitically was that this could not possibly have happened, would not have happened if the Soviet Union had still been a major power. The Soviet Union was unable at that time to respond, and the U.S. there went to a war with Iraq. And after that, there was a debate in U.S. policy circles at the top, right across the establishment, Democratic, Republican, in the national security circles, over what to do soon after the Soviet Union collapsed. And the United States was then the sole superpower. And the question was, what would the United States do under these circumstances? What kind of new world order would we have? And the debate went on for about 10 years, although they started taking action soon in the Clinton administration. The United States got involved in a war in the Balkans, which was formerly a Soviet sphere of influence, and so extended U.S. imperial influence. And you see the discussion of U.S. empire and imperialism among conservatives arising at that time. And Clinton also started to establish U.S. military bases in Central Asia, which had been part of the Soviet Union.
John, let me cut to the end here, because I think we're getting into some heavy detail.
Yes.
We can sort of get to more to the conclusions here. Conservatives that you've been talking about praising empire say this is a good thing, say that the United States is the world needs a dominant power. It needs an empire to bring order to the world. That's not your view. Why do you disagree with the conservative position?
Well, they, Yeah, it's true. I mean, I'm talking about the development of this naked imperialism. And one of the reasons we can talk about it as naked imperialism is that the conservatives are praising it to the skies. They're saying, we are all imperialists now. Essentially, they're saying that the world needs a leader, needs a dominant power, and what better power to control the world to provide this kind of leadership
than
the United States. They call it democratic imperialism.
Yeah, it's not the United States. It'll be China or some authoritarian regime. So isn't it good that we're doing the job?
I think that there are two brief ways of answering that. One is that U.S. imperialism, as all forms of imperialism, is exploitative. So the United States is using its power to reinforce its power. It's extracting surplus from third world countries that are poor. It's transforming their economies and political systems in ways that these populations do not want, but that are preferential towards the U.S. and the other advanced powers. And so it's very it's exploitative. It is opposed to any conception of a democratic world order, even though we say we do it in terms of democracy. The other part of the answer is that it's very unstable. If you have might makes right, that's stable only as long as some other power doesn't arise to challenge it. And inevitably, another power or powers will arise to challenge it. And this pushes the whole world towards world war destabilization in various ways.
Well, John Foster, our guest today in Media Matters, the conservatives also argue that there are tangible benefits to the American people by being the dominant power in the world, that we get benefits from it, not just corporations and elites, but the whole population. In addition to doing wonderful things for people in other countries by giving them our culture and democracy and protecting their freedoms, they claim, we also get, you know, the price we pay for military expenses and taxes comes back to pay for us with benefits to the American people and higher standards of living. So these wars, some of the more callous naked imperialists would say, look, it is about us, and we just have to do this to protect our standard of living and the quality of our lives. Does that argument hold up? Is there truth to that?
I don't think it holds up, but it is true that such an argument is made. I mean, if you think about the Cheney and Rumsfeld and Wolfowitz and all these other figures who have been tied to the Bush administration, been part of the Bush administration, including George Bush's brother, Jeb Bush, as well. They were all part of the project for a new American century. And that sounds like a very patriotic slogan. They're part of this conservative organization to establish American hegemony over the world. And they say that the American population will benefit from this in terms of, because America will be strong. It will stand tall. It will have – its economy will prosper.
I mean, that's the question. Is that true?
No, it isn't true. It is true that the upper echelons of the United States, the top 1%, the super rich, the capitalist class, if you will – will benefit from the increase in American power. U.S. multinational corporations will sometimes benefit, but the notion that the American population will benefit directly or even directly from this is you have to believe in trickle down economics and notions like that anything that benefits the top in our society trickles down to the bottom.
Does there always have to be an empire? I mean, is that the fate of our species, John? That you go back history since the dawn of agriculture and civilization, there's always been in various parts of the world and eventually globally dominant powers that ruled the roost over other nations or other collections or other tribes. Is that our lot, or is there an alternative to having an empire of one form or another, an imperial power?
Well, I think that democracy is the answer, is the alternative, a global democracy. We have to create societies with substantive equality. There might be some conservatives who would look back over human history and they'd say, well, that's a pipe dream, and that we basically are genetically determined to rule by might is right and from Stone Axe days to the present. But I think the American population believes in democracy. I think most of the world's population believes in democracy. I mean, genuine expansion of global democracy, where such things should not be possible. And I think that we have to believe in it. And whether we can achieve that or not will be something that will only be determined by struggle. But past doesn't determine our future.
Our guest today on Media Matters, John Bellamy Foster, professor of sociology from the University of Oregon, author of many books, including the brand new Naked Imperialism. And this is a pre-recorded show. We taped it shortly before going on air. So please sit back and relax and let John Bellamy Foster and yours truly, Bob McChesney, do the yakking today. John, let's talk a little bit about Monthly Review, the magazine which you edit. It is famously associated with great economists Paul Sweezy, Paul Baran, Harry Magdoff. When one hears the name Monthly Review, what is the political tradition that's associated with?
Well, Monthly Review is hard to explain to most people because Monthly Review is socialist and it's identified with Marxism, but it represents an independent socialism, which is not the kind of socialism that people normally hear about. The Monthly Review has always been aggressively independent. It has always been nonpartisan, critical of post-revolutionary states
post-revolutionary states is a fancy schmancy term for communist countries.
Yeah, for communist countries when they were exploitative of their own populations. Monthly Review has adhered to a sort of a classical version of socialism derived from Marx, which says that societies should be controlled by the direct producers, by the ordinary people, that socialism is rooted in radically democratic conceptions in which the economy itself is organized on democratic bases. And so one example is names of people who've written for Monthly Review include Albert Einstein, who wrote for the first issue, W.E.B. Du Bois, Malcolm X, many figures, Cornell West, Francis Fox Piven, people who are important public intellectuals.
And the magazine is written in a popular voice.
It's written in a popular voice, and it's uncompromising in its commitment to socialism. But its version of socialism is also uncompromising. It insists that socialism has to be popular, has to have a popular base.
You know, it was, I think, Edward Said, the late Edward Said, who said that in the United States today, and he said this a few years ago, it's easier to think of the end of the world, the end of our species existing, than it is to think of an end to capitalism and its replacement with socialism. That's how dire the situation had been for socialists, that capitalism seemed so entrenched that it was easier to think of your extinction before you could think of replacing capitalism. What do you think of that comment?
Well, I mean, today we're faced with questions of extinction, of perhaps half the species on the planet, our own potential extinction, and in the face of because of the environmental crisis, and in the face of this, people still hesitate to talk about replacing capitalism, which is obviously at the root of the problem. it's easier for them to assume that we will go into extinction or to accept our extinction than talk about changing the social system. So it's a very dramatic illustration of what he was talking about.
What I mean was that you're on the political left. You see the left in the United States and globally. When people think about socialism, what does that mean today? What does the vision of a post-capitalist world look like? I mean, clearly the Chinese or Soviet examples hold no great appeal, and there's no very few people saying let's establish one-party dictatorships without civil liberties. But what is socialism then in the minds of people who are socialists?
Well, it's tempting to say. I mean, socialism starts with moving away from capitalism, from the logic of capitalism, which is where the profits determine all base fundamental features of the society, where it's driven by profits, accumulation, class hierarchy. We have to have other values come to the top of society rather than simply this narrow economic motive, pursuit of profits, class interest. And so socialism starts with rejecting the logic of capitalism. But, of course, it's much more than that in a positive way. It means nowadays people think of it in terms of movements and broad movements of the population, bringing together diverse social movements, and not just the struggle of the working class for better conditions, which has to be at the core of it, because its control of production is the most important form of control in the society. So you're going to have class struggle inevitably, but people see socialism in terms of linking with other kinds of movements, new social movements, the feminist movement, environmental movement, the civil rights movement, anti-racist movements, the movements for third world self-determination, and the indigenous rights movement. So socialism has changed in how people think about it, and in terms of the ambitions, it's become broader and more ambitious in its conception.
It's the political left, John Bellamy Foster, that works to advance anti-capitalist and socialist politics. And by nearly all accounts, the state of the U.S. left, the left in the United States, is weak today and has been for quite some time. When you look at the landscape, and now I know your age because you're my generation, you've been around a while, do you see patterns in development in the United States left that you're optimistic about? And then maybe to give a more happy ending to this answer, as you look around the world, do you see developments in the last decade or so that give you reason to think that progressive forces, left forces, socialism could advance in the next generation?
Well, I think there has been a lot of learning, and there's in the last decade, there have been a lot of struggles in the world that give us hope. There's the anti-globalization struggle, which I think was it has been a startling new development, because you see an alliance between populations in the first world or the industrialized countries and the third world struggling against exploitation, particularly in the third world, an alliance which could never have been imagined before. You have groups like the World Social Forum that grew out of this anti-globalization struggle. You see alliances between labor and environment, environmental groups that would have been inconceivable in previous decades. You see struggles in Latin America. Latin America has taken advantage of the fact that the United States is primarily involved in the Middle East, a war in the Middle East to break free to some extent politically and to start to create alternatives like in Venezuela.
Okay, like Venezuela. So Venezuela you consider a hopeful sign for the world?
Yes.
What's Venezuela doing that gets you excited?
Well, Venezuela is redistributing the oil surplus that they get, their riches. They're, for the first time, you see a country under Chavez, which is redistributing the oil wealth to the majority of the population. And shortly after the Second World War, Venezuela has been a major oil state, and always it's been controlled by a small oligarchy that has gotten the benefits. Well, the population as a whole has been impoverished, and the changes that are occurring in Venezuela now are very rapid. Healthcare is being provided universally to the poor. There's a spread of education, literacy across the whole society. Redistribution of economic surplus, so everyone has food. Attempts to democratize the firms in the society, and so on. It's a top-down system to some extent, but there are grassroots organizations that are part of the Venezuelan Revolution, which are making this work.
Well, you hear from U.S. news media and from U.S. commentators that perhaps Venezuela is doing this, but it's doing it at the expense of being a free society, that Chavez is one of these caudillo, heavy-handed, ruthless military guys that has no respect for democracy or freedom. How do you respond to that?
Well, he has won election after election. He won a resounding victory in his first election. He supervised helped introduce a change in the Venezuelan Constitution that makes it perhaps the most democratic constitution on earth. One of the aspects of the Constitution is you can actually recall the president. There can be a recall election, and there was such an election in the U.S. The U.S. Government, the U.S. states, did everything it could to support the oligarchy and to try to get Chavez defeated. He won this. Recall election as well. There was also a coup attempt against him, which the United States at least gave its support to, and it may have even encouraged. He survived the coup attempt mainly because of his popularity, because the population mobilized in his support. So, by any standard of democracy, he is a very democratic figure, very backed by a democracy in the full sense. Well, the president of the United States and present president of the United States, George Bush, was not democratically elected in his first term of office.
Our guest today on Media Matters is John Bellamy Foster, professor of sociology at the University of Oregon, author of numerous books. And John Bellamy Foster is also, another hat he wears, and probably the largest hat you wear in the big scheme of things, John, is an environmental sociologist and author of several books about the environment and the political economy environment, probably most famously Marx's Ecology. But there are several other books that you've written about the environment, including the very popular The Vulnerable Planet, used in a lot of classrooms around the country. And let's talk, if we can, about the nature of the environmental crisis. I know you have been following ecological issues as a political economist, as a sociologist for two decades, and written widely on it. How serious is the current crisis? What's the nature of it, and why does this crisis exist in the way it does?
Well, I've believed for a long time that you can't really exaggerate the severity of the ecological crisis, And environmentalists have often been criticized of as being apocalyptic, as preaching doom. I don't preach doom. There are things that we can do, but it requires major social action, which our society, as presently constituted, is unable to carry out. So it requires a transformation of society. But the environmental crisis itself cannot be exaggerated too much. And there are a lot of ways to explain this. But if we just talk about global warming, everyone knows that global warming is a major ecological crisis.
Well, everyone except Ann Coulter.
Yeah. Well, there's no dispute in the scientific community now about global warming. You would find many more scientists who would dispute the theory of evolution than you would find scientists who dispute global warming. And every year, the evidence is more profound. And and soon there won't be anyone left.
left period.
will dispute global warming. It will be too apparent to the entire population. But you can think of global warming as a global ecological crisis, obviously. And I was reading a piece by Jim Hansen, who is certainly one of the leading figures with respect to climate change in the world. He's director of the NASA Goddard Institute for Space Studies and was the figure who first alerted the U.S. population to global warming in his testimony in the Senate in the 1980s, late 1980s. And he has an article in the latest New York Review of Books, the July 13th, 2006 issue. And he basically says we have 10 years. We within this decade, we have to make major changes in business as usual. Or the problem may be uncontrollable. We may not be able to do anything about it. And just to point to what he's talking about, he's worried about temperature rises of say 2 degrees Fahrenheit. He feels that if it gets beyond 2 degrees Fahrenheit past the present, things will be uncontrollable. And he's really worried about an increase of 5 degrees Fahrenheit, which is what business as usual would produce in this century. This isn't even the most dark scenario in this respect. But
well, John, let me know. Rush Limbaugh says, so, what's the big deal? And we can go up to Hudson Bay and suddenly start swimming there, and it'll increase all sorts of opportunities in the northern countries to have nicer lifestyles and just get air conditioning if you live somewhere too warm.
Yeah, well, if just for one example, if you it's not just swimming in Hudson Bay. If it goes up by 5 degrees Fahrenheit, you'll be able to swim in New York, Philadelphia, Washington, Miami. In fact, the entire state of Florida will be underwater. The area where 55 million Americans live right now will be underwater if the temperature just goes up by 5 degrees.
And this is because the ice cap melts and the water level rises, basically.
Yeah, the Greenland ice cap will melt and the Greenland ice sheet in the and Antarctic and the ice in the Antarctic and sea levels will go up if we have a 5 degree Fahrenheit increase. Sea levels will go up by 80 feet worldwide, and the sea level will rise by 80 feet. You see already the increase in hurricanes and so on, with just a relatively small increase in temperature compared to what we're looking at in the next few decades. And he's saying that if we don't stop this within a decade, we're we're either not going to be able to stop it at all, or we'll have to take much more drastic social solutions. But just think, global warming is just one part of the global ecological crisis, and it's all interdependent. But you have species extinction. They're talking about losing 30 to 50% of all species in this century. We've got the destruction of the oceans.
Well, John, let's back up a second. Who cares if we lose 30, 50% of butterflies and amoebas and stuff? What's that matter?
Well, simply in utilitarian terms, you could say, well, so much of what we rely on to create our society, our culture, our technology is really taken from the natural world. If species disappear, there's less there for us. It will be an impoverished world. But it's questionable whether we could lose 50% of the species and not have our own lifestyle change drastically as well.
It's going to be 51%.
But we're talking about loss of ocean fisheries. We're talking about there's a major ecological crisis globally in terms of availability of fresh water, and the aquifers are going down all across the globe, and agriculture will be affected. Even a 1 degree Celsius increase in global warming is supposed to decrease, according to estimates of the International Rice Institute and elsewhere, supposed to decrease wheat, corn, rice production by maybe 10%.
John Bellamy Foster,
are drastic changes.
John Bellamy Foster, our guest today in Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney. This is a pre-recorded show done shortly before going on air, so please don't call in the remaining few minutes we're with you today. John Foster is the author of many books, including Marx's Ecology and The Vulnerable Planet, two of the leading texts on the environmental crisis today. That's what we're talking about right now. John, you've described the crisis. I think a lot of our listeners are familiar with it. Probably a lot of people like myself almost don't want to know too much about it. It's so depressing. How much of this is just due to the fact that there are 6 billion or so people on Earth, and as creatures, our consumption creates these problems? They're unavoidable, and there were just too many of us, no matter what goes on? And how much is due to capitalism and is changeable by people, something we can control?
Well, yeah, one of the things you have to look at it first is just the global inequality, which is made systematic by capitalism. But if you look at just global warming, if you look at carbon dioxide emissions, the United States has accounted by itself for 30% of all the carbon dioxide emissions that have been produced since the industrial age. And so while in Africa, the per capita output of carbon dioxide or carbon dioxide emissions per capita is about 0.25 tons. In the United States, the per capita level of emissions is 5.5 tons per person.
That doesn't cheer me up at all, because that means when Africa and all these other countries start catching up to us, it almost certainly dooms us.
Yeah, well, that's true. I mean, as China industrializes, for example, we're going to see more and more carbon dioxide emissions, and this spreads it across the world. And they're following our model. They're going towards a car-dependent society, a very heavily polluting society. And they're, like us, a very capitalist-oriented society now. They're geared to profits above all. And as long as that's the case, the environment is always second or third or fourth or fifth place in our concerns, and eventually it's going to undermine us. I think that they always talk about the fact that we can create a world that's sustainable, where our economy and our ecology are not in conflict. And I think that is true. The problem is that you can't create such a society within capitalism. Capitalism is geared to unsustainable development. There's no way to make it sustainable. It's geared to the most rapid economic growth, the most rapid accumulation of wealth, of profits possible. You can't have a society that's structured that way and feasibly protect the environment at the same time. So we have to transform society in radical ways in order to get out of this trap.
Do you think there's a groundswell of support for this? I mean, how seriously concerned are the world's people with impending environmental disaster? Or so, let's say American people, since you spend most of your time in the United States. And what explains the level of understanding of environmental issues in the United States?
Well, I think that the media has, you know, is always in there in between the populace and the environmentalists, the scientists on this. So it's a tragedy, really, that the scientists science now on global warming is speaking with one voice. I can't ever remember this happening before, except maybe on with respect to strontium 90 with in the early Cold War era when the scientists almost universally protested against above ground nuclear testing. You have scientists speaking with one voice, and the media is presenting it as though it's a debate. They're presenting it as though there are two sides, that global warming itself is in doubt. And they unearth a couple of skeptics here and there that don't necessarily even have scientific credentials. And they are responding, the media is responding to business and economic interests that don't want to make these changes. So we have a power structure that is preventing change, and more than that, it's preventing the information from getting to the public.
But don't these big, powerful people who own oil companies who might benefit from the current ecological problems, I mean, they need to live somewhere 30 or 40 years from now. At some point, isn't it in their self-interest to have environmental reform, even social reform?
Yeah, and that's what you hope. You hope that that there will be people at the top who have power who will argue for some changes. And there always are some people like that, and they make small changes, but they're basically products of their own position in the institutional order. If you're a CEO of a major corporation, you could be a very, very strong environmentalist, like supposedly Bill Ford at the head of Ford Motors is a very strong environmentalist. And he argues for the environment all the time, a need for environmental protections. But that doesn't prevent him from promoting SUVs. And because if he stopped doing that, they would fire him. He would lose his job.
On that note, John Foster, that lesson in how market economics work, I want to thank you very much for being our guest today in Media Matters. I'm Bob McChesney. I'll be back 1 week from today.